Good evening. My name is Russell. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Russell.
I'm a member of the Carl Gables group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't found it necessary to have a drink since January 17th, 1981. For that, I'm grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous, to the God of my understanding, and to a lot of wonderful people who helped me along the way, including some really fine mentors and sponsors. And tonight, it's, I guess, officially, if you can count, the 10-step meeting. I'm actually going to try to talk a little bit about the 10th step. I want to share something. I'm going to try to share something with you. I don't really sit down and plan these things. I was talking to somebody before I got up today. You know, I've been obviously in AA for a little bit over 30 years. I've heard a lot of speakers, and I love speakers, you know, who share their experience, strength, and hope. And, you know, I've met some people, I've heard some people who are have wonderful stories. You know, whether you call them drunkologues or not, they have wonderful stories, and they have a great talent for telling very entertaining stories and at conventions and things like that. And but some of these people, and I'm not in any way putting it down or anything like that, it's like... I can almost repeat their stories. They tell the same story over and over and over again. That isn't to say that they can't tell other stories, because we have one story. That's our story. But I was sponsored by a gentleman, and I was mentored by various gentlemen. One of my sponsors was a guy named Joseph Snyder. And I was talking about coming up here and trying to explain your experience in a particular step on a particular part of your life, without any sort of like pre-understanding of what you're going to say. And I used to go to these meetings that my sponsor, Joe Snyder, would give. Step meetings, maybe 20 years ago, 25 years ago. Or I would go to a meeting that Ray O'Keefe was doing, or Eddie Edwards, or one of the guys I used to go to these step meetings. And it used to amaze me. I was amazed. I couldn't understand it. I mean, I can understand it. I couldn't understand how these guys could get up and talk for an hour or 40 minutes or 55 minutes. It wasn't just sort of talking about their lives and things like that. I say, how can you do that? And I was an attorney. I was used to talking in front of people, and I said, I couldn't do that. And what I now realize is, you know, all things are possible with God through the Holy Spirit. I mean, the fact of the matter is that as you go through this thing, as you get your experience, and you know that old saying I say about experience, when the man with experience meets a man with money, the man with experience will walk away with the money, and the man with the money will walk away with an experience. When you get experience doing this thing over 5, 10, 15, 20 years to draw upon, and you're able to be transparent, and you can talk, you can share with other people of what's actually going on in your life and what's actually happened, because really, you know, that's what we're here for, our stories. It's our stories that disclose in a general way. Everybody knows, you know, from the get-go, you can talk about your drinking and your screw-ups, and you can talk about how you hurt people and how you hurt your life, but to actually get some time behind you so you can talk about and draw upon your experience while you were sober and how you learned these things, you know, is something that everybody can do, really, if you can get past the fear of being judged and what people think about you and things like that. So I don't really plan a lot about what I'm going to say, but tonight I really want to share something that about the 10th step that I don't think I've ever shared before. And it's not because I haven't wanted to share it. It's because, and I don't know how to explain other than what I'm explaining, this is exactly the time I need to share this. Maybe I couldn't share it a week ago or a year ago. I don't know how. I know there's some people here with like 3 or 4 days. There's some people here with 3 or 4 years. There's some people here with 20 years and 25 years. And, you know, I think I talked in this group about connecting the dots. As time goes on, you sort of like connect it. You see things more clearly. And I don't know whether the same thing works for you, but I'll read things in the book. I'll see things in the book. Lines. Words. That I know I've read 500 times over the last 30 years. 500 times over the last 30 years I've read the same paragraph, and all of a sudden I'll read that paragraph and I'll see a word. It won't even be a line, it'll be a word, and all of a sudden it'll jump out at me, and all of a sudden I notice that word is there, and I say, I've never seen that word before, and it takes on a whole meaning about my life and how it threads through from the day I came in to the day I got, which I, which was meaningless to me a week before that. This whole book changes as I change, as I go through these experiences. And so this is the time I'm going to share this with you. Now I want to say that this is my story. This is my, you know, the book says on page 29, it says, further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recover. These are followed by 42 personal experiences. These are my personal experiences. It says this. It says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view, the way he established his relationship with God. I'm going to talk about God tonight. I'm going to talk about my relationship with him now. I'm going to talk about how I established it and what that has to do with the 10th step as far as I can see it in my life today. You don't have to take offense. Well, listen, you can do whatever you want to do. If you decide you want to take offense at anything I say, that's fine. But understand something. I'm not talking about you. I'm not even saying this is what you have to do, or you have to follow me or do exactly what I do to stay sober. You're free to reject every single thing I say, take parts of it, you know, or accept parts of it, or do whatever you want to do with it. But the bottom line is, I'm not here to entertain you, and I'm not here to tell you stuff that's going to make you feel okay. You know, I have a friend that says bring comfort to the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. You know what I hope happens? I hope at least when you get out of here, you think about what I said. Even if it bothers you. As a matter of fact, if it bothers you, all the better. Because then I've got you. You're mine, you know? So you'll be thinking about it. So I want to share some personal experiences I've had. And because one of the things that I talk about a lot, you know, and people, I know they say this about me and I talk about it. And some, I thank the Lord. A lot of people like it. Some people don't like it. I like to focus on the God aspects of the program and the building up a relationship with God, which I believe is what the entire program is about from soup to nuts. And if you've been here for the last 9 sessions, you know I believe that. You know I've read in the book, and I'm not going to go through the entire book and try to prove that to you or show that to you. You're either going to get that or you're not going to get that. You're going to see that or you're not going to see that. And I'm not here to try to beat that into you. I think it's pretty obvious just by reading the steps. There is one who has all power. May you find him now. You know, it says, see to it that your relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. What I really want to do is read some things in the book about that relationship, about building that relationship which we're supposed to cultivate and grow and have and the growth and the maintenance and the growth of that relationship to make it stronger is talked about throughout the book, from the first step to the last step, from the beginning of the book to the end of the book through the 10th step, and try to explain in my own mind, in my own way, in my own language, based upon my own experience, why I think it is so important as far as the 10th step is concerned. Because what I'd like to have happen, and I know just because I want it to happen, it's not going to happen, is if any way, whether you agree with me or not, if you can walk out of here and say, I can see how that works for him. I can see how that works for him. It may not work for me, but I can see how it works for him. Then maybe I will have accomplished something. I do not remember when I first realized that people, after they came to AA, sometimes drank again. It was early on. I don't know whether it was after I had 3 months or 4 months or 5 months, but I do remember that when I first came to AA, now I'm one of these guys, I'm not putting anybody down to the end, who picked up a white chip at the South Gate Group in January of 1981, and I haven't found it necessary to have a drink since then. I'm a one-chip wonder or whatever it is. And the only reason I like to say that is I want people to know that you are allowed to pick up a white chip and not drink again. In other words, slipping is not necessarily obligatory, you know, and there are people who do it, you know, and that doesn't mean that you can't, if you've had a slip, come back and you can't do it. But I'm one of those guys who did that deal. I picked up the white chip and I didn't have a drink. Now, I've slipped in every other way possible, you can imagine. And I continue to do that, okay? Which is something I'm going to talk about as far as the 10th step. You know, but the bottom line is that when I picked up the white chip, when I picked it up, I looked the guy in the eye and he said, I need help, I can't stop drinking. And I came in here and I picked up the white chip and I'm one of these guys that I felt like I was home. In other words, I didn't feel bad about being here. I had to go through the whole thing where except the fact that I'm an alcoholic to my innermost self and all that sort of stuff and the obsession and go through the whole route of all the problems, almost every problem anybody else has had in here or questions they've had or things they had to go through, I went through the same stuff. But the bottom line is that when I picked up that white chip, it was okay. I was glad I was here. I was happy to be here. I wasn't fighting this thing. I was looking at what these people had and I wanted what these people had. And I don't know what it is. It just never occurred to me that once you pick up a white chip, you go out and drink again. I can't explain it. I don't know what anybody else had that. I mean, I did worry about drinking. I did go through a few weeks of that obsessing about drinking. Am I going to drink? Am I not going to drink? What happens if I do drink? But I never conceived of the fact that there were actually people in here that after getting a number of years would actually go back out and drink again. And there were probably people picking up chips, they're probably slippers around me, I didn't see them. But I know the day came when maybe I had a month or 2 months or whatever. You know, there's a lot of things that go on around you if you're an alcoholic, especially if you're like me. I came in here with two neurons working, they're waving goodbye to each other. I didn't even know what was going on. And you know, you're so self-centered, all you do is just think about yourself. I mean, everybody around you could be dying of cancer. All you're thinking about is whether you got a hangnail or something, all you're thinking about is yourself. And so the bottom line is, it is possible that there were slippers all over and I just didn't even notice it. But I know that the day came when I was sitting in a meeting and some guy with time who had 5 years or 6 years or whatever it is came up and picked up a white chip and my jaw dropped. I was like amazed. I couldn't understand how somebody after having 5 years of sobriety could drink again. This wasn't somebody with 5 days, like 5 years. And then I remember a day. And I may have had like 3 or 4 years or 5 years. I remember a day sitting in the old call room, sitting in the back of the call room. And I was sitting there and it was packed. It was sort of like this group right now. And the person from the podium in the call room said this. He said something like this. And the person who was talking had like 20 years. And I had like maybe 3 or 4 years. And the person on the podium said, you know, I'm so glad I'm here tonight because I see in the back of the room a man named Andy who was one of the founders of the call room some 20 years ago and was one of the greatest mentors I ever had and a wonderful man. He started, and I haven't seen him in some time and he's here tonight and it's Andy and I'm so happy to see him. He was an old timer. And at the end of the meeting, they went around and they did the chips. And they held up a white chip, and that guy, Andy, got up and picked it up. And I like to have fallen off my chair. This is a guy who had like 25 years. And I like fell off my chair. How does that happen? I've seen guys who have done the steps, like I'm doing the steps, pick up a white chip. I have seen that happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, you always think to yourself, don't you think to yourself, you might think to yourself, well, that'll never happen to me. You know, but if you have any idea of this paralysis, like I don't intend to drink, I don't think about drinking, but the bottom line is somehow, some way, I know I have as much respect for the disease, so I know I can be drunk a half an hour from now, somehow. Or at least I never want to get to the point where I say I ain't never going to drink again. It's always there. But when you see stuff like that happens, you say to yourself, why does that happen? I know for many years, I thought that the reason that happened is because I would say things like this. Well, obviously, he hasn't done a first step. I'd say stuff, can you imagine that? Now listen, I'm not God, and I don't know. And maybe that's true. I don't know. But really, can you think about it? Can you imagine a guy staying sober for 25 years, doing step meetings, sponsoring people, and he hasn't done like the first step? I don't think so. I don't think so. It's got to be something more than that. You know, because if staying sober for 25, 30 years, if it was only about the first step, then we wouldn't need all the other ones, and we wouldn't even have a big book. We'd have like a sheet of paper. We'd have a matchbook. Do the first step, and then you're wonderful. It's something more than that. What could it be? Now, many times when I talk about the 10th step, I like talking about the spiritual axiom, because that's when they introduce it. Whenever we're disturbed, no matter what the problem, there's something wrong with me, which is a major thing, and maybe we'll end up talking about it if it interfaces with what I'm saying now, but that's not what I want to talk about now. When I talk about the 10th step, when I look at the 10th step, and this is only me, different people, I don't go into, how do you do the 10th step? Because that's not my job. You read the big book, you talk to your sponsor, I'm not here to mechanically tell you how to put the thing together. I'm here to talk to you about some other things, some other observations I've made in my sobriety as far as the 10th step. See, when I look at the 10th step, to me, the major thing in the 10th step is not, what does it say? Continue to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, probably admit it. To me, the major thing in the 10th step is not admitting you're wrong, even though that's a major thing. You know why? Because that's not new. We do that in the 9th step. It's not about knowing when you're wrong. We do that in the 8th step. It's not about taking personal inventory, because we do that in the 4th step and the 5th step. All the stuff, everything in the 10th step, every single thing in the 10th step, almost, is about continuing to do stuff we've already done. So the 10th step is not me telling you how to do stuff you already know how to do. The major thing in the 10th step, the most important thing to me in the 10th step, is one word. Continuing. Continuing. How many people have ever been on a diet? I'm the only one? I'm it? How'd that, wait, a diet, right?
Yeah.
How'd that work out for you? How do you like when people say, don't do that, or you can't do that, or you have to do this? How do you do with that? You do good with that as an alcoholic when somebody tells you, when somebody lays down the rules and tells you, this is what you have to do. The Ten Commandments. These are the commandments you've got to follow. That's the diet. Here's your diet. The Ten Commandments. Just do these for the rest of your life, always, and never screw up. That's your diet. Okay. Do the next right thing. That's your diet. You have to do. Does that make you feel? Can you do that deal? Forever? Every day? Do you like when somebody goes in your face and says, this is what you have to do? This is what you like that? How does that make you feel as an alcoholic? You say, man, I really like this shit. I like being, I'm an alcoholic. I like being told what to do. Oh, listen, I love doing things because I have to. I love that, I don't know about you, but I'm going to talk a little bit about doing things forever because you feel you have to. I'm going to talk about going on diets and how that works out. Because if the whole thing about that, because every time I've seen anybody slip, whether they have 25 years or 30 years or 15 years or 10 years, it's always been for the same exact reason. Because for one reason or another, they stopped continuing. They stopped continuing. Now, I don't care what they stopped. They may have stopped continuing. I stopped going to meetings. I stopped reading the Bible. I stopped reading the big book. I stopped talking to my sponsor. I didn't even have a sponsor. I stopped doing inventory. I stopped going to the group. I stopped, whatever it is, they stopped one thing or 20 things or 50 things. Whatever the things are, they stopped. It doesn't even matter. They stopped it. And they did it either purposefully or somehow they stopped doing it, and they knew they were stopping doing it, but they stopped it anyway, and they ended up drinking. So how come they stopped doing it and I haven't stopped doing it? How come that happened that way? How come that's the deal? And I want to read a couple of things from the big book, and I have a theory. When I say it's a theory, this is why I believe, see, one of the great things about being sober for a while is you don't have to go by theory. You can actually recognize and go by what's going on in your own life. You can see, you can sort of think and sit back and watch yourself over a period of 10, 15 years, and you can say, what's actually going on with you, Russell? How is this thing actually working with you? And then you can honestly share how it's working with you. And it, maybe it won't work this with you, but I want to share personally some personal stuff as to how this is working with me. And you know, the interesting thing to me is the more I look at myself and I see how this thing is working for me, and the more I read the book, all of a sudden I see something really magical. And what I see that's magical is the thing that's working for me, that I see is working for me, matches up exactly with what they're talking about in the big book. You know, how many people, when they first came in, read the big book, how many people that first come in ever said this thought, nobody will understand? How many ever thought nobody would ever understand you? Did you ever say to yourself, I can't tell this end, nobody's going to understand, nobody has the problem I have, nobody can explain, you know, nobody, you ever have that thought? So you come to, you come into AA and you read the big book about drinking. And all of a sudden you're reading this about drinking, you know, and why we drink and how we drink. And all of a sudden you read this, that's me. That's me. That's me. And all of a sudden you say, wait, somebody understands. You come to somebody understands. Well, I have a book here where there's a whole lot of other areas that I match up with. Now I want to read a couple of things to you. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive, whatever that means. You know, these are words. We read past them, we think we're reading them. It's so elusive. It's hard to even fathom what the sensation is. It's when you think about it, what is the sensation? Why do we drink? It's so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the truth from the false. They cannot, whatever that means. What does that mean? We cannot, you know, we read it, it sounds good, we go on to the next thing. What does it mean? These words have, you can't differentiate the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And you know, I don't think I've ever been to a meeting where it's been on that topic. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. What does that mean? You know, when you feel alone, and I'll put it, I might have told this story before, I'll try to make it fast. When I was 12 years old, I was down at a baseball field, and we used to have like 10 or 12, 15 guys, whatever it is, in Great Neck, New York, and we'd play baseball or football, and we'd choose up sides, and we'd have two captains, and the two captains were usually the best athletes. And I was always, I can promise you this, drunk, sober, then and now, I was always the worst at athletics. I was very good at academics, but athletics, I was the worst. And the way young boys and really men sort of looked up to you is how you did well in athletics. And I was terrible. And they would pick up sides. Everybody, and you've been involved in this, where one captain says, I'll take Joe. All the guys are in the middle. And one guy says, I'll take Joe. And the other guy says, I'll take Charlie. So Joe goes over here, and Charlie goes over there, and they go back. And as they're picking the people that they want on their team, the group in the middle gets smaller and smaller, right? And I'm in that group. And I'm praying. This is what I'm praying. Please don't let me be last. I don't even know whether I believe in God. I'm not a God guy, but I promise you, I remember saying, God, please don't let me be last. You know, as a matter of fact, for me to be picked second to last was like being picked first. It was like winning the Oscar. It was like winning the Oscar. Because I just didn't want to be the one they hated the most. Because, you know, the guy that got picked last, and it seems to me I was always picked last, but it's true that the guy who got picked last, you know, they're never nice kids. They say things like, oh, do we have to have them? And then they all laugh. It's like they'd rather play with one less, you know what I mean? I'd rather play them one less than have Russell on my team, you know? And you know, what happens is, you talk about how many people like being humiliated in front of a group of people? How many people like being laughed at and made fun of? That's a lot of fun, you know? You'd love that, won't you? I mean, you know, the bottom line is that it seems that would always happen. It was most a humiliating, horrible experience I can possibly think of in my young life. In there, having all those guys laugh at me while I'm in the middle and I'm the last one picked. And what I did then was something that I just did naturally. I didn't think about it, it just naturally happened to me. A natural reaction. I didn't even think about it until many years after getting sober in AA. What I did is that they were laughing at me, somehow in my mind I knew that if I started, even though I wanted to cry, I wanted to kill them, I wanted to run away, I wanted them to blow up, I somehow knew that if I let them know how I felt inside, how badly they hurt me, that somehow I would be hurt more. So what I did was I acted on the outside like it didn't bother me. So when they were laughing at me, I would laugh too, like it didn't bother me, even though it bothered me tremendously. And so what would happen is, I would act completely opposite of how I actually felt. And I did that naturally. Now the truth of the matter is, that reaction that I used as a defense, a natural defense, happened over and over and over again throughout my entire life. And that thing that I thought was going to defend me or save me built up such a wall, acting on the outside differently than I felt on the inside. But by the time I was 18, 19, 20 years old, that wall was 4 feet thick. And you were never going to get at me as to what's going on inside me, because I was always acting in such a way so that you wouldn't hurt me or you wouldn't see how I really felt. So my shot of ever having a relationship with you in an honest way was slim and none, because I didn't even know how I felt. I got to the point where I even thought I felt the way I acted instead of felt the way I felt, and I didn't even know how I felt or why I felt these things. But the thing is, to me, my life, that sort of life, that life of fear, that life of being scared, that life of hating yourself, that whatever that life was, to me, it was normal. It was loneliness, being alone or feeling separated from other people was normal. I didn't know I was separated from other people. All I knew, I didn't know I was separate from you. I didn't know I could never have a relationship with you. I didn't know I could never find anybody that I could actually be with and understand me. All I knew was nobody understands me. All I knew is I had this perverse feeling that nobody could ever understand me because I was so unique. I'm probably the only guy in here who ever had that, right? And I didn't know that was abnormal. You know why? Because it says our alcoholic life is the only normal. I thought it was normal because that's the way I always felt. All these feelings I had that were unhealthy, all these dependencies I have that were unhealthy, seemed absolutely normal to me. That's the way I reacted. That's how I had these feelings. So in any event, I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to read a few things to you. And what I'm reading to you, and I've only picked out really a couple of them. They're all over the book. This is on page 63. But what I want you to try to listen for is the phrases and the words that are exactly the same. Because what I'm going to read is stuff that comes out of the third step, stuff that comes out of the fifth and fourth step, stuff that comes out of the tenth step, and I want you to listen for the words and the phrases that are the same. I'm going to give you a little hint, not that you wouldn't do this. It all has to do with the relationship, developing a relationship with God. Why is it important? Why is it stressed so much? Why do they say job or no job? Wife or no wife? You can stay sober. It all depends upon your relationship with God. Why does it say, anything's possible as long as you trust God and clean house? Why is this God thing so important? Why can't we do it without God? How does that make a difference? How does that make a difference? And I think it has something really big to do with with continuing. I think it's the cement that holds everything together. Because this isn't only a relationship with God in order to stay sober for this chronic disease we have, this disease that tells us we're unique. This is not only that. This is about not only the maintenance of that, it's about the maintenance and growth. That's why we have the 11th step. It's not enough that you believe in God. It's not enough that you maintain that belief. It's about maintaining and growing that relationship. And I'm going to talk about in my life why I see that happen, how I see that happening. This is on page 63. They're talking about to stop playing God. First of all, we had to stop playing God, whatever that means. And we've had some, I've had some discussion on that. I'm not going to have that here. It says, He is the Father, we are His children, most good ideas are simple, and the concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. And then it says this, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. He provided what we needed. He, God, provided what we needed if we kept close to Him and performed His work well. God will provide as you go through this life. You know, I deal with stuff now that I've never dealt with before. Deal with cancer. Deal with people, friends, neighbors, relatives dying around me of cancer. I have cancer. You know, as you go through each phase of your life, you deal with stuff that you've never dealt with before. You know, from money problems, there's more. You never get to a life without problems. You never get to a point where you never need help. Where all of a sudden it's perfect. There's no problems. It says here, He provided what we needed if we kept close to Him and performed His work well. Established on such a footing. What footing are they talking about? They're talking about the footing of having a relationship with Him and being close to Him and performing His work well. Established on that footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves. Remember, this is about selfishness and self-centeredness. That's the root. We become less and if you're established on that footing, you become less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, now listen, as we felt new power flow in, as we felt new power flow in, anybody here ever been scared? Anybody here ever been worried? Anybody here ever lose a good night's sleep and not been able to get to sleep because you're worried or concerned about something? Whenever you do that, you don't like that, do you? It makes you feel lousy, doesn't it? You wish you could make it go away, don't you? You're looking for a solution. You can't take dope. You can't take the sleeping pill. You can't take a drink. You do everything you can. Say, how can I make this go away? Your whole mind wants to make that go away, right? But you can't do it, can you? The more you try, the worse it gets, doesn't it? It's a crummy way to live, isn't it? How would you like to live that way for the next 60 years? You better have that new power flowing in. You better have that new power flowing in. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, because you ain't going to get that peace of mind based upon your own power. I've tried that deal. For 31 years, I tried that old power deal. Didn't work out for me. I lost a lot of sleep, and I worried a lot, and was a thumb-sucking crybaby, and I hurt a lot of people. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of His presence, as we became conscious of His presence, as we became conscious of His presence. Who are they talking about? Joe Schwartz? Who are they talking about? As we became conscious of His presence. Hey, let me tell you something. Things are okay. You know why? You know why I can tell you things are okay with me? Because I'm conscious of His presence. You know when I walk out of here and I'm alone in my car? And I got problems, I'm okay. You know why I'm okay? Because I'm conscious of His presence. You know, I wear a bracelet here. You know what it says? With God, all things are possible. You know why? Because when He's present, He gives me everything I need. No matter what's going on in the world. Because I'm conscious of His presence, I believe. You know, maybe it is a matter of whether you choose to believe or choose not to believe. I've already done the thing where I choose not to believe. It hasn't worked out well for me. Didn't work out well for me. I really, quite frankly, given the choice... You know, it's like they said to Bill Wilson, who have given the choice of whether you can do this life with His presence and feeling that way. Maybe it is the opiate of the masses. I'm all for opiate. You know? Given the choice of how you're going to live your life, scared or alone or worried, I'll tell you what, as far as I'm concerned, I choose the God way. I choose this deal. I choose being on a new basis. You know? Mrs. Spatz didn't raise no dumb children. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, we became conscious of His presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter we were reborn. All that they're saying about the remarkable things, losing the period, it all has to do with being contingent upon a certain spiritual maintenance and growth of a spiritual condition that has to do with being conscious of His presence and have a relationship with Him. It's all contingent upon that. May you find God now. It's all contingent. The whole program, the whole mental program and aspects of the program, rise and fall on that relationship. How can you miss that? How can you look at this program and miss that deal? You would have to be so defiant and so willful and so unwilling that you closed your eyes and said, I am just not going to do it this way. But you know, when you're considering alcoholics, if you ever work with them, that happens all the time. But with the alcoholic, this is on step four now. That was step three. But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of the spirit, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found it is fatal, for when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit, from His presence, and the consciousness of His presence. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again, and with us to drink is to die. And why do we drink again? Because we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. Why do we do that? Because we stop the maintenance and growth of that spiritual experience. We stop that relationship. Perhaps there is a better way. We're going on now. We're going through the steps. It's all about God. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis. Guess what the basis is? The basis of trusting and relying upon God. Hey, I ain't making this stuff up. If you want to get mad at this stuff, mad at me, you know, you better write New York. Tell them to rip this crap out of the book. For we are now on the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns, just to the extent as we do what we think He would have us, and humbly rely upon Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate to us what He can do. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. We go on. This thought brings us to step 10. This is what it says. We continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. Listen, we have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Entering the world of the Spirit in the context of this has to do with a spiritual relationship with God. You can't read this thing and sort of divorce this. I love this thing. Well, I'm spiritual, but it's not about God. How can you be spiritual and it not be about God in the context of this? After you read all that, and they talk about now that we're into that deal, not that we have conscious of His presence, now that we believe in Him, now that we trust in Him, we've entered into the world of the Spirit. Tell me how you can enter into the world of the Spirit and say, yeah, but I don't believe in God. How does that work? You got to have a mind a lot brighter than me. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them, which is no big deal if you believe in God, but it's got to be a bitch if you don't. It's got to be hard to do that 10th step. At least the way they map it down there, it's got to be a bitch, don't you think? You know, it's got to be difficult. Then it talks about what happens. We cease finding anything, or anyone, even alcohol. That is the miracle of it. We're not fighting it. Neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. Safe and protected. Man, I'll tell you, if you don't believe in God, if you don't have a conscious contact with God, if you really believe that this is all about you doing the next right thing and you're in control and it's your mind, like Charlie Sheen said, it's your mind that is That is, hey, we got to pray for him. You know, listen, he's either on his road to death or on his way to walk into an Amy and pick up a white chip. That's going to be a bitch. Okay? No, but you know, we'll applaud him. We'll love him. Okay? But you know, if you really believe that it's your mind that's doing this, and it's good orderly direction that's doing this, and you're just following the rules and you're doing this, if that's what you believe, I'll tell you something. I'm going to tell you something right now. You're a hell of a lot better man than me. Because I can't do that. I cannot do that and feel that I'm in a place and position of neutrality, safe and protected. The only time I feel I'm safe and protected is when I have a conscience of His presence, and I know that my Heavenly Father will never let me down, that all things are possible with Him, that no matter how bad it looks, even though they told me I had cancer, it's going to be okay, life or death, it's going to work out because there is a God in my life and I believe in God. And that's the only thing that makes me feel safe and protected no matter what's going on out there. Because if you think for 1 second you even know you're going to be alive a half an hour from now, you're crazy. If you live in this world and you're only over the age of 30. You know that your best plans are your best days, you know. You walk out of this room and all of a sudden the traffic accident, something happens. And all of a sudden, like this. You're gone. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. This is how we react as long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. What does fit spiritual condition mean in the context? It means our relationship with God. God consciousness. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent. You ready? Here's the phrase again. On the maintenance and growth of our spiritual condition. Where have you heard that before? What do they mean by spirit? It means our relationship with God. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God. What are they talking about? Every day is a day which we must, they go further, where we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can you do that without having a relationship with God or without trusting Him and doing His will and performing His will? How can I best serve? Then they even go further. You say this, how can I best serve Thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must, you say there are no musts in A? These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. Must go with us constantly. It doesn't say maybe, or perhaps, or if you want, they must go with us consciously. Now, if you don't believe that, that's fine, because we're all different points of the spectrum. You keep on believing what you're believing, for about 10 years or so, and tell me how it works out for you. Because you're going to get to experiment on this deal with your life. And when you do the next 10 years doing it your way, and you decide that you're going to do it differently because it hasn't been working out, I'm afraid they're never going to give you that 10 years back again. So don't be looking and say, why didn't I do this when I was 30 or 20 or 15 or 40? Because you have the power of deciding how to live your life right now. That's the great thing about God. He gives you free will. It's your decision. We can exercise our willpower along this line. All we wish it is the proper use of the will. Much is already said about receiving strength and inspiration and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, we have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. Where did we hear that before? We sense the power of His coming in. Remember, that was way back in step 3. We have begun to develop the vital sixth sense. What's the vital sixth sense? What was I talking about? But we must go further, and that means more action. Then we go to step 11. What is the vital sixth sense? That's what I'm talking about. The sixth sense of knowing that He's there. Now, atheists think I'm crazy. And I just think they're blind. With the millions and millions of people in this world, some of them are very bright. I don't think I'm stupid. I know a lot of PhDs and everything that believe in God. I don't think it's a matter of intelligence. Some have developed that sixth sense. We developed that sixth sense. Some don't have that sixth sense at all. So how does that work into the tenth step? Let me explain it to you this way. Because you know what atheists like to do? They like to say, well, you sin all the time. You screw up all the time. Christians and good people screw up all the time. And you know something? They're right. They're absolutely right. Here's the difference in my life. And I'm just going to tell you personally how it's working out for me. This is my personal experience with this deal. I have followed the rules, both man-made rules and spiritual rules, like the Tenth Commandment, to the best of my ability, without believing in God, before coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. How many people have tried to follow the rules before coming into Alcoholics Anonymous without believing in God, or without being a God conscious, just tried to follow the rules and try to do the right thing. I'm the only one? Okay. And I have broken the rules before believing in God. I have screwed up the rules. Rules made by man and rules made by God, and hurting people before coming to AA. How many people have screwed up that stuff? Like me. Now listen to me. I have followed the rules after coming to AA. I followed the rules after coming to AA. Don't try to do the next right thing. Anybody ever try to do that? Okay. I have broken a lot of the same rules of man and God. The Ten Commandments, everything. I don't think I've killed anybody yet, but I've hurt a lot of people. Even after coming to AA and after believing in God. You understand? I'm telling you right now, today, I go to church, I'm a deacon in a church, you know, I told you before I'm a Christian, I believe in God, I study the Bible. I sin all the time. I don't think I do as much as I did before, I think I'm getting better, but I'm going to admit to you, I screw up all the time. I do things I shouldn't do. How many still, even though they're trying to do the AA program, find that from time to time, they get angry, they get mad, they yell at people, they do bad things, I do it now. So you're going to say, so what's the difference? What's the difference between following the rules with God and following the rules without God? Between screwing up with God and screwing up without God? And I'm only going to tell you the plain fact difference in my life. When I'm doing stuff, because people are telling me I have to do stuff, or I'm obeying the rules because I feel I have to obey the rules, because I have to obey the rules to get that gal, or I have to obey the rules to get that job, or I have to obey the rules, you know, to stay out of trouble, or I have to obey the rules so that you'll like me. In the back of my mind, no matter how well I'm doing obeying the rules, I don't like it. I don't like being told what to do. I don't like having to obey the rules, even for one day, let alone for 50 years. You know something? It gives me a feeling of being deprived. There's a part of me that wants to break loose and say, screw you. I ain't obeying these rules. I'm going to do whatever I want to do. And you want something? Even when I obey the rules, and even when I do the right thing and I get the job and I get the gal, you know something? There's no great feeling of fulfillment or satisfaction or connection. And you know, when I break the rules or I don't do well in the rules, there's no super feeling of guilt or feeling of loss of fellowship or anything. You know, I mean, there's maybe a feeling of feeling crappy about myself. But let me tell you how it works in my life now. Over the period of the last 30 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've developed this relationship with God, a relationship I never had before. And I still screw up. And I try to follow the rules, but here's what happens. Here's what happens. When I follow the rules, when I do the right thing, you know something? I feel fulfilled. I feel close. I feel connected. You know, because I'm so grateful to God, because I believe that God exists. I believe I have a relationship with God. I believe He loves me, and I have a relationship with Him. And He's with me only. And I know He wants me, because of the sixth step and the seventh step, to be as close as I can in His image, even though I'll never be perfect. You know, I know that's what He wants to do. And when I fulfill the rules and I do the right thing and I do things I'm supposed to do, my reward, the feeling I get of satisfaction because I am doing what I'm supposed to do and I know I'm pleasing Him and I'm grateful to Him is extraordinary. And you want to know something? When I break the rules, when I screw up, when I don't do well, because I have this relationship with Him and I believe He exists, my feeling of disappointing Him and being disappointed in myself and feeling bad about not following the rules is significant. And it causes me to lose fellowship with Him. And it hurts my relationship with Him. And I find I have a desire. I have a desire, a strong desire to try to get back in that, you know, once you experience that relationship, it's like when you have a wonderful relationship with a sponsor. It's like when you have a wonderful relationship with your group. You have a group, you love your group, you love your sponsor. Why do you go back to the meeting? Because I love that meeting. Why do you go back to the sponsor? I love my sponsor. Why do you keep on calling him? Because you love. When you have a relationship with God and you want to keep on having, you want to get closer, you want to keep that relationship. When I fall out of relationship, when I screw up, when I do the wrong thing, and I know I do the wrong thing, and I know that I'm wounding him, and I'm not living up to his expectation, I have a desire to want to get back on track and get close to him and not be out of fellowship. And so instead of doing this stuff, the stuff that we do every day, the stuff that we have to do continually, instead of doing this stuff like it's a jail sentence, like it's a diet, that because people are telling me I have to do it, or you have to stay sober, I'm instead doing this stuff because, you ready for this? This is a killer. Because I want to do it. Because I want to have that relationship. Because I want him to be close to me. And I want to keep on having this. And I know, because of what the big book says, and because of my theology, what it says, that all I have to do is do the right thing, make the amends, go back to him, admit that I did was wrong, and I know he's going to immediately forgive me, and I'm going to be right back in that relationship again. And let me tell you something, that kind of feeling for an alcoholic like me becomes self-perpetuating. I don't have to, in a sense, be feeling like, I got to do this. I can't eat one more scoop of ice cream. It's not like I have to do anything. It arises from inside myself. It's something I want to do rather than something I feel I have to do. And so I think it has a great deal to do when you have a relationship with God, when you have a relationship with God and you feel close to God and you're doing with it and you have that, and you're maintaining, you're growing that relationship, and you want that, and it's doing something for you, it's giving you peace of mind, and you want to perpetuate, you find yourself doing this stuff almost automatically. Because this is the track, this is the narrow road you're on. Because you want to be on that road, you don't want to get off that road. It's very hard to do this, I can't do this program intellectually. I can't do this program intellectually. I've tried doing my life intellectually before I came here. I drank a lot. I hurt a lot of people. I gotta be involved in a program where somehow, someday, because of the Spirit of God, because of my relationship with God, I'm almost compelled to do this program the way it's supposed to be done. So that I don't forget one day and leave the meetings. And I don't leave the meetings. You know why I don't leave the meetings? Because I stay close to him and I do his will, and his will wants me to be in this meeting to help other people. Like Bill Wilson said, what do you think of people that don't drink and don't go to meetings? He says, I have no use for them because they don't have any gratitude. You know, I don't do less meetings. I do more meetings than I've ever done before. I go to Bible study and hang out with those guys because I know that's what he wants me to do. I sponsor people. I don't stop sponsoring people. I sponsor people because I know God's interested in not ability, but my availability. He wants me to be available to help other people because that's what he wants me to do, because it's all about love and loving other people. Why do I do that? Because people are telling me I have to do that? Why am I down here talking? Because I have to do this? Can you imagine that? Why are you going to Little River? I have to do it. I have to do it. I have to go down there. Because they tell me I have to do it. I'm doing it because I love doing this stuff. Because I love being with you guys. I love sharing this stuff with you guys. Because I know it pleases him. Because I'm grateful for my sobriety. So to me, sobriety, continuing, the steps are all wrapped up into having a relationship, a solid relationship with God. I cannot separate it out. I can't do this thing forever without that relationship. It's all a part of the cement that holds the whole thing together. So thank you very much. Next week, we'll talk about that.